Welcome to Boiling Point, the podcast to motivate ever-evolving entrepreneurs and forward-thinking movement pioneers. Our hosts, filmmaker Greg Hemmings and executive coach Dave Vail, are turning up the heat in the world's business communities. Our interviews with entrepreneurs, thought leaders, and movement makers are raising the temperature of inspiration. Live from the hottest studio in this quadrant of the universe, here are Dave and Greg.
Dave, welcome back to the Boiling Point.
Good to be back. How come you welcome me?
Well, because I always get to it first.
Oh, okay.
So next time you have to get to it
first. I'll welcome you.
Now, listen, have you noticed something that's going on my Facebook wall? I'd say once every 3 to 4 weeks, a trend of different type of postings?
No. Okay. And the only reason I say that is that I don't see trends because I'm not in there enough.
Oh, yeah.
So what I do see is a lot of your daughter and all the cool things she's doing. Well, so is that the trend we're talking about?
No, the trend is my doppelgangers. So Music Awards were 2 weeks ago, and Old Man Ludica was in town. The guy apparently looks identical to me, and yes, he does. Okay, now our special guest today, I don't think we look totally alike. However, the place that I met him, somewhere in the mountains outside of Portland, Oregon, standing in line waiting for lunch at a conference, and we're just chit-chatting, and some guy walks by and says, "Hey, you guys look alike," and it ends up being this guy here, Steve Beauchesne from Bo's Brewery.
How you doing?
And from the picture, Steve, there is. Do you see a similarity to Greg?
Yeah, well, we definitely were doing sort of the beard and glasses kind of thing, so that kind of did a lot for it, right?
And I think you also said, Steve, you're like, yeah, you probably think we look like Seth Rogen too, right? And so Steve, you and I have been trying to connect for the Boiling Point for a little bit. We had you on the Millennial Dream talking about being a B Corp brewery. And really excited to interview you here today. So, Steve, why don't you give us a quick introduction from your side about who Steve Beauchesne and Bo's Brewery is?
Sure. So I started Bo's Brewing Company with my father in 2006. We make tasty organic beer, and we try to make the world a little bit better while we do it.
Well, you know what? I feel like we, in a way, we should be having a craft brewing podcast because
totally.
We seem to have a lot of people from your sector.
Steve. Oh yeah, and it's great because
I think it comes from our love of what you guys produce and how it's produced and the kind of the local nature and all those kind of things.
But the shameful thing though, Steve, is you're not in the podcast booth with us because we've had Moosehead in here. We've had Picaroons with Sean Dunbar. Big Tide Brewery. So Steve, can you fly from Ottawa to St. John, New Brunswick and bring us a growler?
I could probably make my way out there when I'm coming up for other reasons. I don't know if that's a good use of carbon footprint to deliver you a growler, but
we'll buy it from Picaroons instead. That's all right.
There you go. I'll be at least as far as Halifax for the Seaport Beer Festival this summer. So
that's close.
Wouldn't be too far further to come see you guys.
And when's that?
I think it's in July.
Oh, fantastic. Well, we will make a point of getting out there, Steve. And Steve, there's so much I really want to talk to you about, specifically about your business model and how you have made some changes recently. But let's just start with your decision to become a B Corp quite some time ago. What led you to do this?
Sure. The decision to become a B Corp started off really as a decision to just do the right thing for the right reasons. So when we started brewing, we were using all organic ingredients. After a while, we had the paperwork put together so we could actually be certified organic. So since then, all of our beers have been certified organic. In 2009, we did an energy assessment, and over the next 3 years, we were able to decrease our energy per liter by 50%. We donate to a couple hundred charities every year. We've donated $1 million to the community over the last 10 years. And so what happened was when we learned about B Corp, it was like, oh, so it's a certification for companies like us. And it was just like when I started talking to Joyce, who was our sort of B Corp rep, she would basically, she'd just be saying, this is what B Corps are all about, and this is why we do what we do. And I was like, well, it sounds like you're describing Bose, so that makes a lot of sense. And we had just completed doing a, it was a sustainability portal that we were helping pilot with, it's called the Provision Coalition. And because of that, we basically had all of the answers we would need for the B Corp assessment. We did the assessment, and we had the marks to join. So it just seemed like, well, we're already doing all this stuff. We might as well, you know, get the certification so that, you know, it's less about us telling people that we're doing all sorts of good things, and more about, you know, someone that can verify that we're actually doing the things that we're talking about.
And in the interview that we had in our film Millennial Dream, you mentioned a really interesting point about your marketing budget is next to nothing as a result of your commitment to just doing things good, you know, and being good stewards of the community. Do you want to touch on that a little bit about the perhaps unintended positive impacts of building a business this way?
Yeah, it's one of those things when, you know, every once in a while when I would go to sort of the original investors who are kind of all friends and family members, and I'd say, you know, we should really do this awesome thing. Every once in a while you'd get a comment back like, shouldn't we just keep that money? You know, what if we declared dividends instead of doing that thing? And the way I was able to really sort of frame it for people was to say, if I told you we needed to spend whatever $50,000 on marketing this year, would you think that was weird? Well, no, of course you need to spend money on marketing. And I said, well, our marketing is going to be word of mouth based on doing these awesome things for the community. And that's when it kind of clicked for him. It's like, okay, if we do the right thing for the right reason, we can hope at least that people are going to talk about it. And it doesn't take long when you're actually doing things like this. You know, when we're at a fundraiser and people are at that fundraiser because they believe strongly in that cause, and then they see that Bose is supporting that cause, it, you know, you just see the click for them. They're like, yeah, this is why a local brewery, an independent brewery, is important to me, because they support the things that I care about, and they're here and they're present. And then when they try the beer and they like the beer too, it's like, you know, everything comes together for them. And rather than, you know, spending marketing dollars so that we could associate it with a sports team, or, you know, do some lifestyle marketing that says if you drive this type of car, you should like our beer. Always been cynical about that kind of thinking. So to me, it's like, if I really want to make you think that you should care about me, I should probably start by caring about you. And that's kind of always driven the thought process behind what we're doing, is, you know, if we want our customers to care about us, we have to start by caring about them.
That's a really good way to look at it. And you know what, I was listening to you, I'm thinking, I can't help but wonder, like, what are the, you know, the philosophical underpinnings of this? That's probably, this philosophy, I'm guessing, didn't just come to you in 2016 or even in 2006 or when you started this company. Like, tell us a little bit about, you know, kind of where the philosophy comes from.
Yeah, I guess I went to my first punk rock show when I was 13 years old, and I'm still an old school punk rocker at heart. And growing up listening to that kind of music, the message, you know, that kept getting reinforced was, you know, corporate greed is hurting society, and there's a better way to do things, and people matter. It just kind of band after band would reinforce that, and it became part of my ethos. And, you know, I grew up being very cynical of profit for the sake of profit, but at the same time, you know, I saw my dad running his small textile company, and kind of also understood that, you know, he was getting to do what, you know, he got to run a business and provide employment. And, you know, so kind of having the two things to sort of juxtapose against each other was, you know, business doesn't have to be bad. Business doesn't have to be good. It's what you do with it that matters. So I think my ethics really were formed by sort of seeing both sides at the same time, and then just feeling like there was a better way to do it, where, you know, you can use your business as a force for good, which ironically is the B Corp kind of slogan, right?
And I was just thinking, like, a lot of it's interesting because we've met tons of B Corps, and at least this is my experience, Greg, you know, is that what Steve's describing, most people describe, I've already felt this way. The B Corp model just kind of fit a philosophy I had, and that's what it was. There's a process to get into it, but philosophically, it makes so much sense to people that are attracted to it. Versus which makes it more pure in my mind than, oh, we're going to do this for the appearance of,
right,
you know, and
yeah,
the byproduct would be, you know.
Well, same thing. Yeah.
That's a really good point, because if you think about it, the B Corp process of joining is so onerous that no one would do it purely for marketing purposes. There is great benefits that come from being a B Corp, but it's more work than you would have to do if, you know, compared to like a regular greenwashing kind of activity. And I think that's an important reason for B Corp to set the bar as high as they do, is because if it's too easy, everyone's going to claim it, and then it's going to water down what
exactly
it's about. But for people that care, yeah, it's like, yeah, this fits my ethos.
Right, right. So you brought up another thing, and I was curious about how this would fit together. So you're describing kind of your, you know, growing up, you know, enjoying punk rock, seeing your dad in business. But as I understand it, your dad's involved in this business with you.
That's right.
Was there any tension around that and the kind of the philosophy and the focus of giving back and maybe, you know, crushing marketing budgets and all this kind of stuff? And or was that just, you know, were you guys completely aligned with that? Because family business is tough, right?
Yeah, it can be. And it definitely took about 8 months of feeling each other out to kind of develop a working relationship that was different from our, you know, father-son relationship. But when it came to sort of the ethics behind things, my dad's got to be one of the most ethical people that I know. So he didn't necessarily kind of have the same viewpoint of, you know, we can use this business as a force for good. But, you know, his relationship with his employees and his relationship with suppliers and the way he ran his business beforehand, I took a lot of learning from that. And I think a great example is, you know, when we started the brewery, we had, you know, about $300,000 that we were able to get between the mortgage and friends and family putting money in to start the brewery, which is far less than you need to start a brewery. But on top of that, when Dad had to shut down his prior business because he lost all of his customers, the company owed probably about $150,000. And what most business people would do in that circumstance is declare bankruptcy, end that, and then start the brewery with this $300,000. Dad refused to do that, even though that was, you know, the easy option and the one that most people would have done. Instead, he insisted that we take the first $150,000 out of that $300,000 and use that to pay back his suppliers from an old business. So we literally borrowed money for our new business and took half of it and gave it to the suppliers, because he was, you know, that concerned that, you know what, we took something from them, we owe them for this, and I'm not gonna stiff them on that. And from my perspective, that was a bitter pill to swallow at first. I'm like, Dad, we need that money. You don't have to do this. It's a totally different business. But then when I thought about it, I'm like, you know what? If someone had bought my beer and then went out of business and said, hey, I'm going to open up a new restaurant under a new name and I'm just not going to pay you, you know, that's happened to me enough times that I know what that feels like, and it hurt. And Dad's refusal to do that was a really good lesson for me, is being ethical, you know, front to back, even when the law says you don't have to be.
Mm, that is such a cool perspective, man. I've always felt the same way about that too, Steve, about, you know, getting into shady places financially, or, you know, knowing that there is always a way out, you know, making those decisions to make sure nobody else gets hurt based on your own decisions, right? And I also think, which is interesting too, like, I feel like I've got the luxury of being in this bubble with people like you, Steve, and a bunch of others, and Dave, who we do run ethical businesses. But so many of my other colleagues in business try to find the quickest way out of paying tax, try to find the quickest way to undercut, and all these old forms of capitalism that has really gotten us to a kind of a bad place is still alive and well. And I feel like I've been living in this really awesome B Corp bubble saying, oh, no, that's long behind us. But it's not. And that's why I think it's so important that we as storytellers, because you as a beer maker, you're a storyteller as well, we continue to share these ideas. Because oddly, this is all very new concepts, being honest, using integrity in business, not stiffing people, you know?
And the other piece of it is then in being successful.
Yeah. Yeah,
right? Totally. You know what I mean? That's what I find fascinating about, like, for example, with Steve's talking about redirecting your marketing budget to charity because it's, you know, because you can, because you got to care about your customers and the people, and the unintended consequence of that is it creates, you know, demand for your product and awareness. And I mean, there's a beauty in that, right?
Yeah, and I think, Steve, this would be a great transition into how you shocked your team. I read this article, I think it was in Conscious Company or one of those magazines, about when you, quote-unquote, sold the company and without telling the employees and how you shocked them. So without me letting the audience know what happened, why don't you walk us through the day that you told all your employees to meet for a very serious, important meeting? Walk us through
that. Yeah, sure. Sure. So basically, we brought everybody in the company together at the old Repertoire Theater in Ottawa, which in itself was, you know, kind of an odd thing for everybody. When they came in, they saw a bunch of people they didn't recognize in suits. Everyone had to give over their cell phones. They sat down. Dad and I walked in, and basically we said, you know what, I know that when we started this company, selling out was the last thing we would have ever considered, but you know, the way that the brewery's grown and the way that the market's consolidated and globalization, we really felt we had to reconsider this. And so, you know, to protect the brewery for the future, we decided we had to sell the brewery. So we'd like to introduce you to your new owners. Coors All Natural is now owned by, and then we flashed up the goofiest picture we could find of one of our employees, and we said it's now owned by Rod Gilbank, which is actually the guy's nickname. It's not even his real name. And then another picture flashed up, and it was like another goofy photo of an employee. We're like, and JPAC. And we just kept putting up more pictures with more names. And people, like, when they saw Rod Gilbank, it was like, oh, this has just been a big joke. Okay, I get it. And then as we started naming more and more people, they're like, oh, this isn't actually a joke. This is actually happening. And then you could just see, like, you know, the tension before we started saying it was huge. And there's this huge sigh of relief when they realized that we weren't selling out to a major brewery. And then when people realized that they were actually getting to own the company that they've been working for, you know, just like tears of joy, you know, erupted out of the crowd. And it was quite a cool moment. And sort of to kind of backtrack on that, obviously we'd been working on developing an ESOP and employee share ownership plan for several months beforehand. They're quite involved things. But in doing it, I was really, my biggest concern was that I didn't want to do this awesome thing and then have one of my employees find out because they read it on Facebook or they heard it on Twitter or something. So it became super important that I got to tell people directly, and Dad did obviously too. And so we had to do this whole cloak and dagger thing because we couldn't, you know, tell a bunch of people and then hope that they wouldn't tell anyone. So we kept the people in the know to like maybe four or five people in the whole company. And those suits that people came in were literally like the accountants and stuff that were making it and the lawyers to make it happen. But I kind of realized, well, if we've got to make it a huge secret, why don't we have some fun with it? And that's where that all came about.
You are such a prankster. Yeah. So were people freaking out, like thinking that Imbrew is going to come and buy you or something?
Yeah, it was actually really funny. Like, you know, people were holding hands and, you know, clutching their seat chairs, and you know, there was a lot of tension in there.
There's
a video of it you can actually watch.
Oh,
online.
I was wondering about that.
You know, you can just see the looks on people's faces, and they're like, "Oh God, don't do this."
I was thinking, like, how hard was it for you to keep a straight face when you saw the initial reaction. Like, because the best practical jokes, I believe, I mean, and it's, I don't know, this is not just a practical joke, but it's a wonderful way to expose people to it. But I mean, are when you can keep that tension long enough and, you know, for people to slowly let it, you know, create that awareness that this is the real outcome. But I mean, how hard was that not to, to maybe start cracking up, or you just see the anxiety it's creating?
Yeah, I mean, on the day of, it was such an emotional experience for me as well. Like, it was actually, it was harder not to cry than it was to, you know, keep the smile in.
Yeah, good point.
Because, you know, this was a monumental event for me. And it was, this is me saying, I love you guys. And to show that, you know, I'm you know, letting you own this company that Dad and I started. And so it was actually was harder to sort of fight back tears than it was to keep the smile down. But, you know, like, because we've been working on this for so many months, I mean, I'm, you know, the poster child for transparency. So keeping secrets for me is a very difficult thing to do. And that was like the hard part, is like, you know, you'd be talking to someone, they'd say something about, well, yeah, you know, whatever about this thing or that thing. And you're like, you know, you're going to actually own this company in a few months, you know, and that's where it was hard to kind of keep the secret in and keep from giggling. Well, you know, 'cause, like, I've got this secret.
Well, Steve, I was so inspired when I read that, man. And it made me look deeper into ESOPs, et cetera. This totally is in line with your character and your values. Like, when you're talking about those early punk rock roots in values, it makes so much sense that you're going to share the wealth in this setting. But what brought you to deciding on an ESOP model?
Yeah, there was, I guess, two major things that converged. And the first was, you know, Dad and I started the brewery. We've hired all of our unemployable friends and all our family members. And then we've been hiring people, you know, that have become friends through the process too. And every time we bring someone on, we're like, we want you to feel like you're part of the family. But over time, you kind of realize that, you know, you can say that as much as you want. You can do your best to kind of make someone feel like family. But when part of the family owns the company and part of the family does not own the company, the part that doesn't own the company doesn't feel as much like the family as the other part. Mm. To me, I'd almost say it was like, if we hadn't promised it to anyone, but it felt like an unspoken promise. If we're going to treat you like family, well, family members get to own the brewery. So why shouldn't you? And so that was the one half of it. On the other half, from the very first day that we started selling beer, we had fans coming up to us saying, I love what you're doing. Please keep it up and do me one favor. The only thing I'm going to ask you to do is never sell out to a major brewery. And year after year, that's been repeated by almost every single person I've talked to about Bose. It kind of dawned on me that if I were to sell the company, it would be doing the one thing that the people that have supported me have asked me not to do. And it would be such a violation of their trust that it just seemed like I couldn't do it. There's no way I could sleep at night if I did the one thing that my fans had asked me not to do, because I owe all of the success of the brewery to them. Like, they're the ones that keep us in business.
I love that concept of your customers being fans, being family, but really, they are owners as well. They've got that sense of ownership. Like you said, if you've got a customer saying, don't sell, and you're listening, they've got a sense of ownership over your story, which I think is amazing. You know, that's a real powerful thing. When we talk about marketing, you didn't pay a cent for that. You know, like, that is,
yeah, exactly,
amazing. Okay, we're coming close to the end here. Just for understanding of scale here, Steve, how many employees do you have working there that are now owners?
We've got about 150 full-time employees who are now owners, and about another 35 that are currently part-time and currently not owners, but there's an opportunity to transition a number of them as well.
That is wild. And how much beer are you guys producing on a monthly basis, or whatever metrics you measure that on?
Yeah, so last year we brewed about 6 million liters of beer. So it's we're a decent sized craft brewery, a regional brewery at this point.
Yeah,
you know, you compare that to, you know, the first year in business, I think we brewed 30,000 liters of beer. And on the other end, you can compare that with like an AB InBev who spills more than 6 million liters of beer a year.
Yeah, no kidding.
Spill more than that a day, probably. So it's still very, very small compared to what large breweries are like, but it's been incredible growth from our perspective.
Well, and look at, think of all the families you're impacting just with your employees. I mean, that's a great story. In terms of people getting your product, like how far does it stretch beyond, you know, the brewery?
So we, most of our sales are in Ontario and Quebec right now. But over the last few months, we've started selling across the country. So you kind of have to hunt for it, but you should be able to find it pretty much everywhere now in the country if you're looking for it.
Yeah, and I have seen Lugtread, I believe, at NBL. Is that possible that you would have had?
Yeah, they've been kind enough to put some on the shelves for us. So that's great.
So listen, this is the last question. What was the most influential punk rock band in your high school days?
Probably Operation Ivy.
Operation
yeah,
Ivy.
I'd go with Operation Ivy. Kind of more ska punk, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And for me, Steve, I take it a little bit further back and onto the British side, and it was the bands like the Buzzcocks that were all that old British stuff that was kind of pre-punk a little bit.
That was
my high school world. And even getting into like old Kinks, you know, like you could tell.
Yeah, totally.
And even early Pink Floyd, oddly, had a little bit of that too. So there's a song by Pink Floyd called The Nile. Just remember that. The Nile.
Okay.
You got to find it on iTunes, listen to it, and send me a note. Tell me what you think. Like, this is really interesting music history. So the other thing is, Dave, he plays in a band. We play in a band. Someday we're going to do a show together. We haven't figured that out yet.
I'm coming. And I imagine there's going to be some great beverages there as well.
Yeah. Well, Steve, thanks again, man, for your time. And we'll see you in Halifax at the big show. And for sure, we'll see you in Toronto at the Champions Retreat.
Sounds good.
All right, Steve.
Nice
take care,
meeting,
man.
Steve. Take care.
Cheers, guys.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
6 million liters of beer.
My goodness. You can't help be inspired by that story.
I know. Like, it's almost like it tests our own selflessness or selfishness. Like, when I think about that, too, it's like if I owned a big, successful company with a lot of employees and tons of sales, like, to say, you know what? These are the people that own this. And to go to create a proper ESOP, philosophically, I'd like to do that. Is it realistic? I don't know. I mean, but that's why having these conversations are so inspiring with people like this, is
absolutely.
To say, how do we look at our, and in a way, your business, Dave, with Vision, with so many different coaches, there's a whole bunch of different models that you can, that you probably already are playing with, profit share models and all this sort of thing.
But it makes you want to take it a step further, or this idea of like, if and when there's an exit, like how do you make sure the people that were along on the ride and created the value, you know, get some benefit, right? And, I 100%. But you know what I love most about that story is it doesn't sound like there was any expectation, like people were pushing for it, right? And they did it for all the right reasons. I mean, why else would you do it, right? In their case, right? Like, if it wasn't pure intention. So, I mean, that's amazing. I'd love to see the video. That's got to be.
We'll look that up. In fact, Matt will be able to find it and post it into the show notes, which would be really cool.
Can you imagine how their lives have been, everyone's lives were impacted by that?
I'd love
half,
to see that. I would love to see it.
And all the planning that went in and the idea that he sounds like you said, he mentioned being very transparent, you know, doesn't like to hide secrets.
Well, just like me. You know, I can't do practical jokes on people because I'm too honest. You, on the other hand.
Well, we're not sure. There was, your name is loosely affiliated with a political campaign that was around an election in our province, and I saw these signs pop out saying "Vote for Handsome Dave" and this bad picture of
you.
Me.
Still think I was behind that?
And
I wish I was behind that.
I don't know who was behind it, but I get nervous when I hear elections coming up and that sign will show up again.
Who's got the sign now?
I have no idea.
So just for the listener's sake, Dave is not a politician, but in our last provincial election, when all the signs are up, say, vote for so-and-so, somebody got a picture of Dave and said, vote for Handsome Dave, put it on the side of the road. And for some reason, he thinks that was me.
Well,
I had nothing to do with it.
I don't know how much time we have, but I'll tell you why.
Why?
Because I started getting texts from all these crazy numbers saying, oh, you're running for election. Like, I mean, from numbers like all over North America, right? In the night. This is a Saturday night. And I'm thinking, oh, I go, at least it hasn't hit social media. At least it's just coming to me via text. I'm going to find this sign because it's my community, right?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden the next morning, there's a post on Facebook. First thing, Greg Hemmings.
Yeah.
And then everyone knew about it, so...
Because I shared it.
Yeah.
Well, I think I shared it from Kim, our Bowling Point team member.
Yeah, well, I shared it from somebody. I think Kim's affiliated, too.
So, I am not affiliated with... I wish I was. No, listen, the other thing I wish is we had some Bose beer with us right now.
I know.
We, you know, as our guests know, we do these back-to-back.
And actually, for the listeners, maybe you should spell the last...
B-E-A-U-S.
The name.
B-E-A-U-S.
B-E-A-U-S.
I hope that's right. Jeez. Hold on a second.
Because you wouldn't naturally know that.
Yeah, and the beer is fantastic.
B-E-A-U-S. It is, in fact, Greg.
Yeah. B-E-A-U-S. And if anybody wants to see Millennial Dream, we've got probably a good 8 or 9 minute segment about Steve and his team in the film. So you can look up Millennial Dream on, you can watch it on iTunes or on Amazon Prime. Check it out. And anyway, that's it. I'm super inspired. So I guess we'll leave it at that, Dave. And I had nothing to do with that song.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Boiling Point. Remember to rate and subscribe to us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter at Boiling Point Pod. To see more from Dave Vail, check out leadershipunleashed.ca or visioncoachinginc.com and on Twitter at Dave_Vail. And to catch up with Greg, visit hemmingshouse.com and at Greg Hemmings on Twitter. Thanks for listening and remember, keep that pot boiling.
Hey listeners, I'm Christy.
And I'm Melissa, and this is Buried Motives, where we dig deep into the details of some of the most gruesome
dirtbag murderers. She said she enjoyed hurting things that can't fight back.
And that is a disturbing view into the mind of a murderer. And such a dirtbag.
Yeah, that's not even strong enough words. This is totally a recipe for disaster. And not to justify whatever is going to happen, but you can totally understand and see how this would be in the works.
If you were only to look at what she did later on and not know any of that history, she would appear like off the wall crazy.
Oh, 100%. Because we're not even close to getting to the end yet. But you can just see this pattern and all this kind of stuff developing in her, which is what we're here for. We're digging deep.
Join us each Thursday as we unearth the dirt bags that live among us
and the motives buried there. Hope you join us as we exhume the truth.